You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
I'm Sam Edwards. I'm third-generation cure master from S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at SurreyFarms.com or VirginiaTraditions.com.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides, and my co-host today is Janet David. Janet, say hi to everybody.
Hello from Roberta's in Brooklyn.
Right, and my usual co-host, Carol Butler, is busy working on her book. Her next book is on bedbugs, and they try to get it out as fast as they can, so she's home tethered to her computer working hard. So Janet has consented. Janet is my partner, my lover, and everything else in my life, just about. So she is here, and she's my co-host today. And last week's show was on gardening, and Janet spoke about her experiences working as a gardener in Central Park. She's a volunteer gardener, and if any of you don't have any place to garden, and you want to garden in one of the biggest gardens in this city, it's 840-something acres of gardens, you can volunteer to work in Central Park also to be a garden. Just go to Central Park Conservancy /volunteer, and you'll be able to find a place in the park. Okay, so today, the second show on gardening, and I'm going to talk about a friend of mine named Sim Ross, who was a terrific gardener and who died about a year ago. So this is sort of a memorial show for him. And also, it's a fascinating talk about different kinds of gardening and gardeners and all that stuff. So my friend Sim... I met, many years ago. He started out as a veterinarian, and when he graduated from vet school, he went to Cornell. He went out to Wisconsin and wanted to have a farm practice. So I think they bought a little farm, and he proceeded to be a farm vet. And I put up a picture of Sim at that stage of his life. He's wearing coveralls like a farmer or like a veterinarian who has to deal with animals. So you'll see that picture on. So folks, when we're finished with the show today, go to the site and you'll see many pictures of Sim and some other people that I'm going to mention. All right, so I told you about the photos. And so what happened to Sim was that the farm practice wasn't working out too well. And meanwhile, his brother, who was also a vet, asked Sim to come back east and work with him. And they opened up a joint venture on Long Island, and they were very successful. So I met Sim after he had moved back from Wisconsin and was working with his brother as a vet and was living in Smithtown, where Sim and his wife Alice had a big piece of property around this old house that they had bought. I think that house was from the 18-something or others, but it was in the middle of a big flat piece of property. Maybe at one time it had been farmed. I don't really know. So Alice and Sim... put in this huge garden, and I remember loving to go to visit them because they had this great old house, and my kids were young then, and my kids would come and play, and Sim had put up a tire swing in the yard, and everybody would swing on the tire, including Sim. Sim was a very outgoing, athletic guy, and he loved life, and he loved doing a lot of things. So that's my memories of Sim and Alice having their great garden. And by the way, Alice was a home ec teacher. And when she was almost retiring, she found another career. She got a degree in foods, and she became a specialist in the colonial cooking. And she had a whole setup in what used to be the garage, a kitchen and everything else, where she used stuff from her garden and demonstrated how cooking was done in the colonial times. And also her son, Peter, who when I met him was just going into high school and was a drummer. he practiced his drums, but Sim became a blacksmith. And, Peter. Well, what happened was we were volunteering for the museum on Long Island in Stony Brook, and they would have a fall festival, and they would train you in one of the old trades and crafts. So we volunteered to learn how to be coopers, to make barrels, and they told you if you're a beginning cooper, if you make a barrel that will hold an apple, it was a successful barrel, because it was really tough to do. And his son, Peter, wanted to learn blacksmithing, so he did, and he apprenticed with a blacksmith at an old Bethpage restoration, and eventually he became the blacksmith at Williamsburg. And he was very successful, and when he retired recently, he bought a little farm in North Carolina, and him and his wife, Louise, also have a garden. So he's following in Sim's footprints. And some of Sim's footprints were usually pretty muddy at times from walking in muddy gardens, and when he worked on the farms, it was pretty muddy. So hopefully we'll have pictures of Peter's garden, and Peter has chickens. So we visited Peter and Louise last summer when we were on our trip to West Virginia, right, Janet?
That's Tennessee,
West Virginia and Tennessee. So just to get back to Sim's history, he... When he was with Alice, who was his first wife, he had this terrific garden. And then when he married Renee, his second wife, and they lived in Greenlawn, they also had a terrific vegetable garden. And you'll see pictures of that vegetable garden also. So we're still involved in gardening. And I told you some about my friend Sim. He loved gardening. And he wrote an essay about gardening that we're going to read now, because it's beautifully written. And for anybody who's ever worked with the soil or worked with gardens, and anybody who loves loves life outdoors and all that, I think you'll appreciate it. So Janet and I are going to take turns reading it, and then we'll go back to talking about other kinds of gardens and things like that. So Janet, are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm going to read the first part. It's called My Garden and Me. Okay, just a little footnote before I start. He wrote this in 2009, and he already had cancer. And he was so tough that he gardened right till he couldn't do it anymore, right?
Till a few days before he died, he was actually out in the garden, able to pull weeds when he couldn't really do much of anything else, but he could do that.
Yeah. Okay, he says, I feel so good about our vegetable garden, and the sun is out nicely. So I decided to let you all in on what makes our life special here. And he's talking about living in Greenlawn on Long Island. Going out to our garden is like getting involved, really involved, in spring. It's like opening a new window. It's not very big, but it is a different piece of our life. There are wood-lined paths throughout that keep your feet where they belong, which is off the growing medium, where the plants are located. We send a soil sample to Cornell every few years and add some things to make sure we have a correct medium for the best growth. He's talking about the Cornell Agricultural Extension Service that's out in Suffolk County. He would send soil samples to see if it has the right balance of nutrients. And you can do that too if you have a small garden. You can send them a sample of your soil and they'll tell you what you need to get it in perfect shape. We don't have a large enough area to completely rotate the crops, but we do some companion planting and use marigolds and herbs that help prevent unwanted interlopers. So he's talking basically about bugs. And I don't think they had trouble with woodchucks or anything like that, like Erica had, and certainly no deer. We compare growth and results each year to the previous year. It is interesting that different years, different crops prevail. Last year, we had a tremendous crop of leeks. They came in so thick, it was difficult to select the ones to pick. But we did do it and made and canned a quantity of potato leek soup for use during the winter. For you folks that don't know what leeks are, they're like green onions. They're like scallions, but they're much thicker. If you're not familiar with it, you should try it. It's a tasty, very hearty soup and a wonderful warmer in those cold, damp days in January and February. Leeks will be ready soon and will be made into soup for the coming winter. This year, it is Swiss chard that takes all honors. Janet, you want to take the next section?
We try to eat seasonally, which means that we eat as much as possible as the crops mature. Our first crop, rhubarb, pokes its leaves up in early spring, and it's always exciting to see, and we welcome the oncoming season with it. It reproduces itself each year with very little care and tastes delicious in a pie. In fact, it was known as pie plant in the Midwest, or used as a dessert stew like applesauce. It starts us off in a good frame of mind. Next comes lettuce, and we plant it in different varieties, romaine, bib, leaf, and colors, red and green, for the best looks and flavors. So this is salad time for us, and the real start of eating fresh foods, not store-bought items. By now, other crops have been planted and are starting to be available. As I mentioned, chard is up and ready and continuing to lead the crops. We have great amounts of it with different color stems, red, yellow, and white, and have most beautiful large green leaves. We live a simple life here, and I don't mind eating the same thing frequently. If it tastes good on Tuesday, it will taste just as good on Wednesday and on a few successive days. And we eat delicious chard 3 or 4 times each week. We cook it like spinach, sautéing the stems first with onions, small tomatoes, a little garlic, steaming the leaves, sometimes adding a few small bacon bits to the mixture. Try it. It's better than spinach.
Okay, thanks, Janet. Right now, August, September, we are overloaded with tomatoes. I think that's a thing that most gardeners have at the end of the summer.
Yeah.
A plethora of tomatoes. Okay. It has been notoriously bad year on Long Island. We had an inordinate amount of rain and cool weather this spring, and it damaged the tomato crop with much blight. For some unknown reason, we were spared that, and except for 2 plants that sickened, we had and still have a bumper crop. We have picked and eaten it, made sauce and canned tomato soup and tomato pies, pieces for the winter. We had a large crop of yellow grape tomatoes that were absolutely delicious. We and some friends picked and ate them right in the garden. Now, that's a nice experience. If you've never done that, pick a warm tomato from a vine and eat it when it's delicious. You had that in your garden,
yummy.
Right?
Delicious, yeah.
In Fire Fabulous. Island, you had those tomatoes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, small ones.
Small little grape tomatoes, right.
Yeah.
We and some friends ate it in the garden. Okay, in general, store-bought tomatoes have been shipped, picked for looks, not flavor, and are far inferior. Garlic and chives come back every year. Our minor crops are the usual. We go radishes, red and white onions, carrots, peas, beets, cucumbers, wax and green beans, broccoli and herbs, a few peppers, which did poorly this year, and parsnips. Parsnip is especially used by us as a vegetable, not in the normal soup dish. We saute it, slice it in and slice in orange juice, and add a smidgen of maple syrup when indicated. Parsnips remain in the ground in excellent condition most of the winter, and we dig them only when we need them for dinner. I can remember visiting Sim and Renee in the wintertime, and they would go outside and get a parsnip, wash it off. It's a root vegetable. It looks like a giant radish. And they would slice it up and cook it up, and it was delicious. And I also remember visiting Sim in the springtime, and he always gave me strawberry rhubarb jam because he spoke about rhubarb as their first crop, and he always made jam out of it. And strawberry rhubarb jam is used. It's delicious. If you eat it with chicken, like cranberry sauce, or with turkey, it's really absolutely delicious. Or if you make a pie out of it, then it's really good. Okay, where were we digging? Okay. Okay, it's great to have special little things available when wanted. For example, while mashing a potato for dinner, it's simple to walk outside the kitchen door and pick and cut a handful of chives for dressing. Just a little something that makes life pleasanter and maybe fuller. We gave a carrot to our daughter recently, and she said it didn't taste like a carrot that they bought at the store. Janet, you want to? I'll do that last sentence. Of course, you know, he talks about people using Aunt Jemima syrup, not maple syrup, on pancakes. So he said you have to develop the paste, the taste, because maple syrup is so far superior. It's expensive, but if you use it on pancakes and things like that, it's really delicious. Aunt Jemima can't compare to it.
Okay.
Go ahead, John. Yeah.
Along with the garden, we make compost, a most important product. We save and use our kitchen vegetable scraps, no meat, and pile it into a 4x4 bin to let it rot, which it does with no odor noticeable. And within a few months, turns into a rich black compost, a heavy and valuable soil conditioner. We have two bins, and what I put in during last spring and summer is now ready for adding to the soil or storing it to be used in spring planting, while the second bin is filled with scraps and leaves for later. Making compost rejuvenates the soil and is a natural process in the woods and forests. I enjoy doing it and caring for it. We don't use poisons or pesticides to limit or remove invading insects. Some of the caterpillars, the larvae, and adults are truly amazing organisms in their own right, being able to be very adaptable to their specific food source and are quite beautifully put together.
Okay, thanks, Jen. I haven't mentioned the emotional aspect of our garden, so this is really the most beautiful part of this essay, and they are many. Walking into our garden together gives Renee and I a good communal connection to each other, but it also connects me to the earth, like no other activity does. It makes me aware of everything around me that is part of the great recycling of the world, and true recycling is what it is what it does doing this. I always stop to look up at the sun and thank it for its light and heat. Getting into the garden gives me a connection to the myriad humans all around the globe that are doing the very same thing right now. Growing food is a universal occupation, and people often overlook this most important activity. I don't. I respect it and wonder at the complexity of the different systems involved. I just plain feel good when doing some simple task, but realize how significant it all adds up to. We do add fertilizer to the soils as we think they need it, and mix it in well to distribute for the plants. Knowing what each area needs takes more studying, but it makes the things more understandable, and the results show very quickly. In addition to the immediate feeling, I get a connection to the season. This summer, when everything edible grows for the year, and it makes me aware of the coming fall and reawakening spring to be anticipated. I enjoy being part of it all, the colors of the fall, the long sleep of winter, the awakening of spring, and the glory of another growing season. Sim Ross. Okay, so I know it was a little long to read, but I hope everybody appreciated that. And this is dedicated to my friend Sim, as I said, who died last June of cancer, and he tried to work in his garden until he couldn't work anymore. And his wife Renee carried on, and if you look at the pictures on the site, you'll see a picture of Renee in her garden, and Peter Ross, his son, in their garden. And I think there's a picture also of Sim and Peter building the hen house, because they have chickens in their garden. And when we went to visit them last summer, we wanted to go out for dinner, but they said, no, we have enough. And right, Janet?
Right.
And they went out to the garden, and we helped them, and we picked all kinds of stuff for dinner,
right. And
some eggs from the hens. And they whipped up. It was like being on a farm. And
right.
Peter and Louise's place is like a small farm.
Right. The whole meal was from their garden. It was
quite
delightful.
It was really terrific. So that was good. So make sure you look at the photos on this show. Okay? So now I'm going to talk about other gardens. How are we doing with time, Jack? 1 minute? First segment? Okay. Okay. So we're going to talk about other gardens. Now, when you say garden, what's the difference between a garden and a farm? I think it's just the size. If you have a garden that's very big, I think it's almost like farming. So I don't know the real definition. Jenna, you know?
Nope.
Okay. So we'll talk about mostly about gardens. because most people listening, and I don't think they have big farms, okay, except for the guys out in the Long Island City at the Grange, which they have an acre on a roof. That's really terrific. So, so as I said, you only need a small area for a garden, okay? Like my daughter Erica has these one in a bathtub and one in another container to keep the animals from eating her crops. A lot of communities now have community gardens where you get a plot of land. I remember when I lived in Huntington, the town of Huntington had community gardens that you could use. All you had to do was sign up for them, and they had water supply right there, and they even had tools that you can use. So there were families who would come out and plant their crops and harvest them. It was great. There's nothing like getting fresh food from the garden to eat, right, Jen?
And growing up in Brooklyn, not too far from where we are right now, during World War II, I was a child, we all had victory gardens. That was to help the war effort. And, of course, it was also a great source of inexpensive food for us.
Right. And I remember that when I was in elementary school, they used to sell seeds to us kids to encourage us to go home and plant the victory garden.
Right.
And most people did it.
Yep.
And I remember you, Simeon David, who was a member of the family, and he worked, he had a garden in the Brooklyn Botanic Garden.
Right.
He had a garden plot. Do you think Peter had one too?
I'm not sure.
Peter, who's a cousin,
yeah.
He may have had a garden there too. But I remember Simeon always talks about his garden in Brooklyn Botanic Gardens,
right,
where he was a gardener. Okay, so that's another example of a community garden. So gardens come in all shapes, sizes, and colors. And I'm going to talk about a few more different kinds of garden after the break.
A garden in the rain, close to a little leafy lane, a touch of colony skies of gray. The raindrops kiss the flower bed, the blossoms raise their thirsty heads, a perfume thank you they seem to say. Surely here was charm beyond compare to view. Maybe it was just that I was there with you. Was just a garden in the rain, but then the sun came out again and sent us happily on our way.
This is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Thursday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Flash Talks Cash, hosted by Joanne Flash Fleming. Flash Talks Cash is a weekly talk show discussing personal and small business money issues. The show examines current topics from the financial tax world and the ways it impacts your wallet. The focus is to help people and small businesses find ways to make money, save money, spend money, and know what to do with your money when you get it. Again, that's every Thursday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
The Calhoun School.
Okay.
Okay.
You just tell me when.
Okay. Hi, back on the air with the second part of the second gardening show. So if you folks missed the first show, it was on last week. It was about gardening, and it was very informative. And my host today, my co-host is Janet David, and she spoke about her experience as a volunteer gardener in Central Park. And I said, if you want a garden in one of the biggest gardens around, 840-something acres, you can garden in Central Park. So today we're going to talk about some more gardens around the city. Since we live in Manhattan, a lot of this information is restricted to that. But if you live anywhere in the country or anywhere you get this program, I'm sure you can always find a place for a garden. So, Janet, you want to tell about the which one are we going to do? Brandeis's garden?
Brandeis High School.
Brandeis High School, okay.
Okay, Brandeis High School is in our neighborhood on the Upper West Side, and It's been divided into mini schools, and there's one school, one sub school that specializes in gardening and teaching kids how to garden. And there's a plot of land on a corner of very, very high real estate neighborhood that they managed to preserve so that these kids can have an experience growing things in the garden. And once a year, it's open up to the public. It's not open otherwise because of insurance issues, but once a year, this garden on 84th Street and Amsterdam Avenue is open to the public, and the kids serve not things particularly from the garden, because a lot of it is flowers and herbs, but some of the neighborhood restaurants provide food. But the kids then have to also kind of run this party, and there's music from some of the local music schools, and it's just a treat to see this. Even if when you can't get in, you can walk around the perimeter, and here's this big chunk of green right in the middle of a very, very busy neighborhood. So it's just a pleasure, and it's a pleasure to know that kids are that interested in gardening and that they're really learning stuff.
Right, and the city owns that piece of land,
yeah,
and they let the school use it for their curriculum on gardening.
Yeah.
And while doing a curriculum on gardening, they get a lot of science in also,
right,
you know, photosynthesis and yeah, all that other good stuff about soils and the interrelationship of critters. And there's a lot involved. If you want to do the science, there's a lot of biology to do about breeding plants and preventing insects. Who are normally in gardens, prevent them from eating your crops by using natural means. Yeah.
In the same neighborhood, there's a private school called the Calhoun School, which has a garden on its roof. They do not have enough land around it to do a garden. And this school has the reputation of having the best food of any school in the city.
Right.
They actually have a chef, not a cook, an actual chef. And the kids do the planting up on the roof. It's mostly herbs, some vegetables. And one of the things that they learn about is nutrition and seasoning and cooking. And the chef takes the kids up to the garden. They help him, you know, pick the appropriate herbs and plants, and then they get to see that in their school lunches.
Right.
So that's another nice thing going on in the middle of Manhattan.
That's a terrific thing to do. Have a school garden. That's mm-hmm. the best. Yes, and there's an elementary school that when I walk by to the museum on the 6th on 79th Street, 77th Street. Yes, there's an elementary school. And they have a school garden that I pass by all the time where they're growing vegetables. And I'm sure the kids love to pick the vegetables and eat them. And if they kids who won't eat vegetables at home when their mother cooks them, they'll eat vegetables from their own garden. So that's a big plus also of having a garden like that. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some other gardens now. I spoke about Erica's garden. And, we have another garden that I wanted to talk about. Janet mentioned the Calhoun School Garden, right? And we spoke about the Victory Gardens before, and that's what we need now in this country. We need another form of Victory Gardens. And we can call it something else, but the president's wife, Michelle Obama, has put in a vegetable garden at the White House as an example to the rest of the country that everybody should have some kind of a garden, because if you tasted fresh fruit from the garden, it certainly tastes much better than when you buy it in the supermarket. And let's say you buy cauliflower in the supermarket, it usually comes from California. That's 2,000 miles that it had to be shipped, right, and kept cool. And then it gets delivered to the store, and it could sit in the store a week. And by the time we get it to eat it, it could be 2 or 3 weeks old. So it certainly doesn't taste the same as if you picked it fresh from the garden and cooked it right then and there. Okay, so that's, we spoke about that. Oh yes, and I mentioned hydroponics on the other show. I just want to mention it again. It's Boswick Farms. They're in Flushing. It's this company run by these nice young folks. If you don't have enough room for your garden, you can do hydroponic farming, which is doesn't require much room or much soil. Okay, I'm going to talk about another kind of farming, fish farming. Now, most of us can't do fish farming in our houses, but fish farming is becoming a very big industry. You know that we're overfishing the stocks of all kinds of fish in the oceans and all other places. So fish farming is becoming more and more popular. And there are problems with it because when they raise the fish, let's say we visited a fish farm when we were up in Canada. Remember we saw those salmon growing?
Yeah.
In that net enclosure with the, they were growing these big, beautiful salmon. The problems were is they were feeding the salmon what they would normally eat, which would be smaller fish. So they were feeding them fish meal that was made from herring and other small fish. And they, it uses up a tremendous amount of that stuff. So they have to find a way to feed these salmon more efficiently so they don't use up all the smaller fish that live in the ocean, because then there won't be any food at all in the ocean for the big fish. So it's all a very it's a balance to do. Also, when the fishes are in this netted area and they produce waste like all living creatures do, the waste is more concentrated there. If they were free swimming around in the ocean, it wouldn't be so concentrated. And when you have waste concentrated, you start growing bacteria and other things. So there's a new way of fish farming now that I just read about, and we're going to try to visit them. And it's a fish farm called Local Ocean, and it's up in the Hudson, New York, which is a town that really needed some industry, because we visited it last year and it was sort of going to sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, it used to be a very important town in the old days when the steamboats went up and down the Hudson River. But so anyhow, this company has developed a way to grow fish in big tanks, and they're growing tilapia, and I think there's branching out into bass and bream, which is a fish like a bass. And also they're going to try to grow flounders in this facility. And they're going to do it and use a recycling system so none of the water goes back into the environment. In fact, they're using fresh water, which doesn't have any salt in it. And if they're going to grow saltwater fish, they're making their own salt water. In this article I read, they got salt from the Red Sea or the Dead Sea in Israel. And they're using that salt. I don't know why they're using that salt. There's plenty of salt in New York State, but I don't know. I'll give you a report when we go to visit them. So they are fish farming, and they have this system of closed circulation. So what they do is, after the water is supporting the fish, and the fish are eating, and the fish produce waste, the water is recycled through a filtering system, just like in your home aquarium. So they're filtering out all the waste, and then they can reuse the water again. So that's a very good advance in fish farming, because, as you know, we're overfishing everything that there is. Okay, just to change the subject a little bit, there's another show on the Heritage Radio Network called We Dig Plants, and that's all about gardening. And those folks are experts, so if you listen to their show, they really know about plants and about gardening. So, Jack, when is that show on? We Dig Plants. Jack's the engineer here. He knows everything.
There you go. Sorry. It is on Sundays at 3:30.
Okay.
You can find all the podcasts on our website.
That's right. Oh, yes. All of the podcasts are archived. So you can listen to any show you want at any time. Okay. So let's say we broadcast this show we recorded it on Monday at 12 noon. I know most people are out working or doing something else. But the shows are archived all the time. And you can listen to any time you want. Okay, so I'm gonna read a little article now about funding for gardens. So I found this. This was sent to me by my friend Lou Siegel, who's a very active marine biologist guy, and he's right up on what kind of funding is available. So I'm going to read to you, and then we'll talk about this a minute. Individual awards. This is from the state DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation. Individual awards will range from $2,500 to $50,000. Okay, all you have to do to get this award is to apply for it. A wide variety of projects are eligible for funding, including community gardens and green roofs. Now, what's a green roof? A green roof is a roof that has plants on it, even just grass. And why is it good on the roof? Because it soaks up the sunlight and it reflects a lot of sunlight. So if you have a black roof, you know it gets so hot you can't walk on it. So the next step is to paint your roof with silver paint so it reflects all the light, and it'll save you a lot of money in the heating bills and cooling bills. The other way to do it is to make a green roof where you have a garden on your roof. And the plants on the roof will absorb the solar energy and produce food and flowers and all that stuff. Okay, air and water quality monitoring. If you want to set up a program of air and water quality monitoring, you can apply for a grant. Lead poisoning prevention. You know, we used to have a big problem when lead was in gasoline. We still have a problem with lead from paints and other things and burning some fuels. Urban forestry. That means gardens and forests that are in cities, in urban areas. Okay? This is a pretty wide-ranging area for the funding. Subsistence fishing education. Now, that sounds very strange that they would have funding for this. But if you want to encourage people to eat fish that they can catch locally if the waters are safe, then that's what they mean by subsistence fishing education. To teach the people and many kids how to catch fish that are grown sustainably. Like in our local waters on Long Island in the bays, you can catch fish like porgies, which are small fish, and they're hard to find in the fish market sometimes, but if you can catch them locally, you certainly can eat them. Environmental education for urban youth, inventories of local pollution sources. Now, we're out here in Bushwick in Brooklyn, and we have a big pollution problem out here in Newtown Creek. And Newtown Creek has been declared a Superfund site. That means the federal government is going to give money to clean it up. But the thing that prodded it along and helped along was a local citizens action group. And this group could have applied for this funding because there's certainly plenty of pollution going into Newtown Creek. And if you remember, there were people kayak on that creek, but now the city stopped them because they were afraid if they fell in the water, that the water was so bad it would dissolve them into slime. But it's not that bad. And now the city said it's okay to kayak on the creek again. Okay, and green worker training. That means you can train people who are out of work to get jobs in the green industry, which means solar energy and green roofs and things like that. Okay? The applications are due Friday, September 9th. And awards are expected to be made in November. During the last funding cycle in 2008, the DEC awarded 50 grants totaling $1.6 million. So the money is there. If you have an organization or just a couple of individuals, I'll tell you how to get the application and apply for a grant. You never know if you can get it or not. The Office of Environmental Justice, that's an organization devoted to conservation and all that, they had a series of outreach workshops. But the workshops are, let's see, yep, you can still attend some of those, and they give you detailed information about the EJ grants and the application process. Community-based organizations, community leaders, residents, elected officials, media, and other interested stakeholders are welcome to participate. Workshops are also scheduled in Manhattan, Staten Island, Queens, the Bronx, and on Long Island. Additional workshops will be scheduled in Brooklyn, Westchester, and in Newburgh, the town of Newburgh. For more information on these workshops, can be found at www.dec.ny.gov/public/31226.html.
Read it again.
So I'm going to read that again. Now, if you have trouble remembering this, you could write to us at Heritage Radio Network, Attention the Naturalist, and ask a question, and I'll send you an email with that address on it again. But I think it's worth trying if you have some kind of a group and you want to apply for funding, because you see all the areas, a very broad range of topics that they will fund. Okay, I'll read it one more time. It's www.dec.ny.gov/public/31226.html. A lot of dots in there. So if you want that information, just send me a little message, an email, and we'll get it back to you. So we have 1 minute left, and just as a wrap-up, I hope Sim Ross's family gets to hear this show, because I contacted them, and they sent me some great photographs. So Sim's children who are living around the area, his daughter Janet, who's living with Alice, in Smithtown, and his Janet has two beautiful daughters who are working. One is working in New York City, and one is in, I think, Bowdoin College. Okay, and then there's Harry Ross, who lives way out in the Boulder, which is a beautiful town. And Harry Ross has two beautiful daughters also. And then there's Peter Ross. And Peter is the one who followed Sim in his footprints of gardening, because Peter has this great garden. And Peter lives in North Carolina,
yep,
right near Siler City. Now, if you want to know where Siler City is, go on a map and look it up, because it's a very small place, but it's in this area where there are a lot of farms and all that. And by the way, when we went to visit Peter last year, we stayed at a goat farm, which was down the road from Peter. Beautiful goat farm. You can go visit it, and they'll show you how to make goat cheese, mm-hmm, and yogurt.
And milk the goats.
And, we watched the goats being milked. And tell them about the little playpens with the goats.
Yeah, they had a lot of kids, goat kids. And somebody had given them a kind of a playset that you would use in a backyard or in a nursery school. And the kids were actually, the goat kids were climbing up the ladder and sliding down the slides and climbing around like little human preschoolers.
Right. It was really nice to see. And that's near Peter Ross, who's living in North Carolina with his wife, Louise. And I'm going to sign off the air soon, and Jack can play that nice tune. Gardening, what was it?
Garden in the Rain.
Garden in the Rain, where gardens need rain a lot. So this is Bernie Wides and my partner today.
Bye-bye.
Janet David, signing off. And remember to look at the photo galleries, and you could see pictures of all this stuff.
I recall a summer's day when you and I had strolled away, and suddenly a storm blew out.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. It's with great sadness that we mourn the loss of Ray Dieter, owner of the DBA Bars and co-host of Beer Sessions Radio. Ray made this studio brighter every Tuesday at 5 p.m. with his larger-than-life personality, charm, wit, charisma, and expertise. We hope the archives of Ray on our station will serve as some kind of window into the life of a man who meant so much to those he knew and those he didn't know. And on behalf of everybody here at Heritage Radio Network, we thank you, Ray.
And they've been doing that for many, many years. And how do they get that barrel of beer? Did you ever hear of a place called Beer Mountain?
I have not, actually.
Beer Mountain is a place that I climb every once in a while to find barrels of beer for my customers. I go up there. I wear big, heavy boots. I carry a sled with me because there's snow and ice. And I go to the top of the mountain, and I bring back barrels and bottles of beer for the people at my bars. And that's where I got it from, Beer Mountain.
You're awesome, Ray.
It's better for growing things. There's just more rain and more regular temperatures, not as harsh a winter.
Sure.
So it just became more economically viable to grow it there.
Can I just make a statement? I want to apologize to everybody that asked me why hops weren't grown in New York State, because I've told everybody there was a hop blight. I just pulled that out of my ass.
So why did you open a bar in New Orleans?
Well, everybody asks that question. The basic reason I opened a bar in New Orleans, down there, obviously it's a drinking town. It's a lot of drinking town. It's also a culinary town. They have some of the best restaurants in the country down there, and people told us we were crazy bringing a good beer, good whiskey, good drinking concept down to New Orleans, because all the people wanted was, you know, huge-ass buds. And that's all well and fine, and there's a lot of fun to be had on Bourbon Street, but there's a lot of shit going on down there away from Bourbon Street. And we opened up DBA in 2000, and we had a slow beginning because we had a pretty good list and people were like kind of intimidated. But once the restaurant people, the chefs, the service people in the restaurant industry kind of got wind that we were down there and we had a great beer selection, we got filled up pretty fast. I mean, it worked out real well. And we opened our second place called Mimi's down there. And another aspect about it is down there, you know, a bar owner is a respected member of the community. We pay our taxes, we employ people, and we're part of the whole trade industry down there, the whole tourist industry. In New York City, we're not treated quite the same, and you know that as well as I speak. We're kind of treated as we're not a respected member of the business community as bar owners, necessarily.
So you like New Orleans?
I love New Orleans.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio. Ray Dieter, a.k.a. Bootsy Collins, was just on the air. Ray, what was it like in the old days? Did you have a band or something? Bootsy Collins, Ray Dieter, DBA.
I play guitar a little bit, but yeah, it was kind of boring. The beer business is a lot more fun, Jimmy.
You're just too cool, man. I love you, man. Ray, tell us the Tom Peters story. I know you've known him for years.
Yeah, you know, I have known him for years, and all the stories that I have about Tom, I cannot tell you on the radio.
How about a general beer theme story, like
okay,
the first time you met him? How about that?
Okay, the first time I met Tom, he was running a bar in Philadelphia called
Copa 2,
right. And he was, I went down there, DBA was a brand new bar. We went down there, and he was one of the most generous, wonderful guys. He's like, oh, DBA, I love you guys. Like, how did he hear about us? I have no idea. But he knew who we were, and he treated us like kings. And free food, free drinks, so generous. And then I found out that he didn't own the place. So it's like, oh, that makes a lot of sense now.
If anyone's offering a course like that, it's a scam.
It's absolutely. I took a course at NYU about opening a bar, and it was just a fallacy. It was just ridiculous. They have no idea. It's all about math, too, and the math they talk about is really fun, but it's really not pertinent to what you do on a day-to-day living. Yeah, we need beer. Can somebody open some beer?
All right, I'm all over this. Give me a minute. Give me a
My
bottle.
My glass is empty.
This is the first show. We haven't been drinking beer nonstop. Right.
Hey, Ray, how are you? How was your weekend?
You know, my New Year's is fine. I made a few bad choices, but you're supposed to. That's just what it is. New Year's is about making bad decisions. And I did that. But it, all in all, okay. I lived through it.
Like I say, we're the only brewery in the world. We have wooden oak casks. So
yeah.
Cooper.
When are we going to get some casks?
That's the reason. I mean, these casks, We sell them in England. You can't ship these things across the Atlantic Ocean.
How about if provide the casks?
Even if we do provide the
casks.
When
I say we, I mean by America.
Well,
and by America, I mean Union. Union beer.
Cask beer done the traditional way, as we do it, has a shelf life of probably about a week after it... after it's brewed.
Yeah, but we have some casks coming over here. I know the Shelton Brothers bring some casks, and I know that the United, another importer, brings some casks.
I mean, that's fantastic.
And they're fine.
I'm really glad that you appreciate, you know, that's great for you that you have English cask beer. But, I mean, to be brutally honest, the way that we do things at Sam Smith's is that we are very, very traditional, and that's what we believe our success is based on, is sticking to what we do best.
But if IPA was made to be sent to India, and that's before airplanes and big steamships. I mean, if you really want to be traditional, you can, like, you know, we can get a donkey cart to come around south of Africa or whatever on a tramp steamer and bring it over. But I think it's time for Samuel Smith's to be available in cask occasionally for special events in New York. A lot of the beers in England, I mean, most of the breweries, the old school English ale breweries, would make a barley wine, but it wasn't, they weren't proud of them. It was something that they kept under the shelf, and it was something that, like, the old guy with a really greasy red woolly cap in the corner would get a little glass, and it was like, he would get a little bottle of it, it was about 6 ounces, and he'd pour it into his ale.
Yeah.
Because nobody would sit there and pound barley wine like we do here in America.
Right. Yeah.
And that barley wine that he was pouring into his ale.
It was fortification, yeah.
Right. His ale was about 3.5%. It was a session beer. And the barley wine back in the day was probably about 6%, 6.5%.
Right.
And he didn't want to be seen drinking that because only old drunks drank barley wine. But that's a whole old profile.
Little nip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, so he would dip that little glass into his ale, and he would drink that. He'd sip that and quietly have a nice day.
Can't wait to be old.